Om Shanti. So just before we start, there's an announcement from the transport office. Those who are leaving to Ahmedabad from tomorrow onwards, please check your transportation from the transport office. Note, the Bubba's bus, which will be leaving tomorrow, 3rd of January, is cancelled. Please reconfirm your transport again from the transport office today as soon as possible. Okay? Om Shanti. So the other day, I think some of you were in the class and some not, but we were talking about feelings and emotions. Who was in the class? Can you see the difference after observing for a few days? You can see the difference between feelings and emotions? Can you? Who can? Put up your hand if you can. Okay, and who can't? Okay, just one, two. Okay. Because we can touch on that a little bit in this topic, nonviolent communication. So I came across this teaching, I guess, of nonviolent communication probably about 15 years ago. And at the root of it is the whole concept of compassion. And it starts, you're okay? It starts with the question, what is it that makes us lose our compassion, and what is it that helps us to hold on to compassion under the most trying circumstances? For example, Nelson Mandela. How did he maintain compassion through all those years of what could have been felt to be injustice, but how did he keep compassion? And what compassion is, it's a connectedness. To me, it means connectedness. Connectedness to our common humanity. Baba was talking today, so many things related to today's topic, but soul consciousness is connectedness. And what's very interesting also is that in this whole work of non-violence, this aspect of compassion kind of underlines the whole thing. And so many stories of people being in life-threatening situations, and yet by keeping the connectedness with the other person, they were totally safe. We heard the other day about Vedanti Ben's experience of being in a car. You were there the other day. And four people got in the car. She was just waiting in the car for the owners of the car to come out of the house. And four people jumped in the car and drove off with her in the car. And, you know, what can you do in a circumstance like that? They are four. You are one. But if we stay connected, they're actually just human beings. And what she said, hold on, like that, hold on. And they stopped and let her out. And we can be surprised when we hear that they actually stopped and let her out. But the thing, that's what compassion is, and that's what this connectedness is, that we keep treating everyone as a human being. No matter how they are behaving, we keep seeing them as a human, or for Brahmins, even more powerful, as a soul. Because by nature, it's our basic and most fundamental learning that by nature we're all peaceful, loving, happy, you know, beings. And so if we keep looking at someone like that, they behave like that. And I, because, you know, I often share a story like that, people always tell me their stories. So I can tell you 20, 30 stories of people being in life-threatening situations, but by keeping their connectedness and not looking at the person as a monster, not becoming afraid, they were able to save themselves by communicating. Like, for example, I'll give you another one or two. There was a situation where this woman, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and she was awoken by a sound, and there was a strange man in her bedroom. And she was practicing this non-violent communication, compassion, connectedness. And she was thinking, how do I connect with this person? You know, how can, what can I say to this person to just connect, to just make a connection? So she said to this person, she just asked him, what time is it? That's what came to her mind. She asked him, can you imagine? There's this strange man in your room and you say, what time is it? And he said, it's 2 o'clock. He answered, you know, he looked at his watch and he said, it's 2 o'clock. Already you are making that person human, right? Because that's a very human thing to do, just look at a watch and say 2 o'clock. And then she said to him, she's thinking, what can I say to this person? So she said to this person, how did you get in? Did I leave a window open or something? So he started to describe to her how he got in and how he found her room. And in a way, that's very interesting because that makes him quite close to her. Because not many people know your house, right? He's quite intimate already with her because he knows her house. So by this time, by the time he told her how he got in, she already felt connected to him, like just on a human-to-human level, right? Because they're talking. And she felt already that she could say to him, I would like you to leave. She just said to him, I would like you to leave. Because the thing is, once you're connected, you can make a request, you can communicate human to human. So she said to him, I would like you to leave. And he said, I've got nowhere to go. Then what to do? So she said to him, there's a room downstairs, and in the cupboard there's some sheets and a blanket. You can stay downstairs tonight. I want you to be gone by the morning. I won't call the police. Such non-violent communication, no? Very clear. Very, very clear. Compassionate. And she said, you know, you go by the morning, I won't call the police. And of course she didn't sleep all night, she was so nervous, but he went down, made a bed, slept, and left the next morning. Just like that. And I can tell you, as I said, 20 stories like that. That when we make people kind of connected to us, human, when we keep treating people as humans, they behave as a human being. What our mistake is we very quickly go into fear and start treating someone as a monster and very different to me, you know? And that's the danger. Actually, the most dangerous thing in any situation is fear. Fear is very dangerous. You know, they say there's only two prime emotions, fear and love. And fear is very dangerous. The most dangerous thing is getting afraid. If you're not afraid, then you've already won the battle, pretty much. There was another woman, I'll just tell you one more, again, amazing. She was on the beach and this man approached her and he said, oh, do you want to go and see the mountains? And she said, she was telling us in a workshop, a BK workshop, but she wasn't a BK. She said he wasn't attractive, but he had some kind of charisma, like a power over me. And I said, yes. And she said, I'm so embarrassed to tell you that I said yes, because it's such a silly thing to do. So she got in the car and she saw that he's going away from the mountains, opposite direction. I mean, you can see mountains, right? And she was terrified, sitting there in a frozen state, you know, which when you're afraid, you can't do anything. You just freeze. Then she just got this thing to talk to him, to come out of her fear. So she said to him, oh, this is amazing that you come down this way. My friend lives here with her two children. Maybe you know her. She just made it up. She just made it up to make conversation. And then as they drove along a little bit more, she said, oh, that's her house. Amazing. Just stop the car a minute. I'll go and see if she's inside. He stopped the car and let her get out. See, you would think that's strange, wouldn't you? Because he's captured her. He's got an intention. But when you make people human, they just behave human. It's a habit. So he let her get out. Then she went up to the door, she knocked on the door, thinking that at least I can go inside and save myself. No one home. So she went round to the back, and can you imagine, she found a woman with two children getting in a car. This was all by chance. She found a woman with two children getting in a car, and she said to this woman, I'm in danger, I need to get in. And this woman let her. That's not also so usual because, you know, it's quite dangerous for her and her children. And as they were driving out past this man, the driver, not her, the driver said to the man, we'll be back in a minute, just dropping the children. All weird, you know? All really weird. But that's what happens when we just don't become afraid and we keep being human, at least human. I mean, we've got the advantage of being soul conscious, which is even more powerful, but just being human, we can. So this is compassion, connectedness. So the whole basis of communicating non-violently is to stay connected with each other. Because so often, we're actually not connected. It's just the way we've been brought up and conditioned, because all of us are, you know, boxed into our little ego space, and we often feel that we need to survive. So we walk around as these individuals. But when we are connected, that barrier is not there. And then there's communication. But if you think about it, if you really look and think how you communicate, you'll probably see that a lot of the time we're judging, assessing, labeling, doing so many things to ourselves but to others also. And I ended up in a workshop. It was a conference on non-violent communication that happened to be in India, in a place where I happened to be. Can you imagine? Because this is my interest for 15 years, and there were like 15 trainers of this non-violent communication. And I thought, you know, after 15 years, I would be quite okay at communicating non-violently. But the main thing to be non-violent, the word is empathy. I don't know if you've got that translation right, but sympathy is different. Empathy is like compassion. It's a connectedness. You feel, you can feel what the other person feels in empathy. And what it said in one of these books on nonviolence, it said, even people who think that they are empathetic, they are not. Right? And I thought I think I'm quite empathetic. But when I did an exercise of talking to another person and somebody is an observer and was listening, you know, someone trained in this nonviolent communication was listening, that person kept correcting me all the time. You know, I wasn't an empathetic listener. You know, I was surprised, and all I want to do for the rest of the time is keep practicing, because I feel, I wish there was a little kind of person here just correcting me all the time when I'm not compassionate, when I'm not empathetic. Because for me, this, you know, is the... Baba today was talking about being sweet. How many times, I think, did anyone count how many times he spoke about it? I used to try to use another word for Baba when I'd write to Baba. I'd think, I always say sweet, let me use another word. I want to use another different word. I always use the word sweet. I cannot leave out that word when I write to Baba. And interestingly, there was a brother in America, Harold, very original jewel. And he wrote a book, and his publisher and the editor, they said to him, because it was about the BKs, and there was, he kept using this word sweet. He was German. No, he was American. And she said, you can't use this word sweet. You know, people think that's kind of, I don't know, at least in English, they think it's very sticky, it's very kind of childlike. No, it's not a very cool word. If someone says you're sweet, it's like only grandmothers use words like that, that kind of thing. So she said to him, please replace this word sweet. It doesn't sit right. And then that lady, this was years ago, so she met Didi Manmohini. She was visiting the States. And after meeting the BKs and Didi, she said to him, okay, I surrender. You can use the word sweet. Because there's no other word. You know, there's just no other word. Because sweet means not hurting, you know, non-violent. It means gentle. It means, one word I like for Baba also is benign. Benign means you can't hurt. You can't hurt. It's just like not in you to hurt. You know, it's not even being good. It's just like you don't know how to hurt. It's like that. So Baba's very benign. You know, you see Baba when they play holy, if you've ever seen. Nowadays it's not as gross as it used to be. But they used to get these big sprays and spray Baba. You know, and Baba would be all wet and yellow because... And Baba just used to sit there, so innocent. I used to feel, how can they do that? He's so defenseless. You know, he never defends. I can't imagine Baba ever defending. He's just defenseless, benign, sweet, so soft. So Baba today was saying he's a mountain of sweetness, and we need to be like that too. So to me, non-violent communication is very connected to being sweet, meaning not to hurt in any way somebody else. And the other day when we were talking about emotions and feelings, I was mentioning that emotions is different to feelings. Emotions is a reaction. Emotions is ego-based. And I decided to drop emotions because I can't deal with them. They just make me crazy. And I actually had a little situation yesterday where I went to Pandav Bhavan to sit in Baba's room. And I came into Baba's room like 5:15, so there was no one there. And of course I was so happy because I saw that seat in the front, you know, that prime seat, because I don't do too well sitting on the floor. So that seat was there, and I thought, oh good, I can sit on that seat and sit here for at least half an hour or so. But then I saw a name on the seat. It was reserved. So a little bit of this emotion came up, a little bit of reaction, a little bit of ego. How can somebody reserve a seat? And it's a wealthy person, that person. And I said, you can buy anything now. You know, these emotions started to come up. And then I thought, but I don't know the story behind this. You know? And that brother does a lot of service, incredible amount of service. And I just thought, and I was just observing. And then when I got in touch with my feelings, I thought, because the whole thing about nonviolent communication is getting in touch with your feelings and your needs. So I asked myself, this is to clarify a little bit the difference between emotions and feelings. I asked myself, what's my feeling? What's my need? And then I realized, actually, I don't have any feelings and needs in this. It's just an ego reaction to see something like that. And I thought, do I have a need? No. You know? And I thought, do I have any real feelings about this? No. You know, so I could see that it's just a reaction. It's just emotions and based on ego. So I could just drop it. Because I was thinking, you know, he'll probably come any minute. I sat on that seat defiantly. And I thought, he's probably going to come any minute. What am I going to do? Am I going to sit here? I'm going to give him the seat. And he did come within 5 minutes, and I thought, what does it really matter? You know, what do we fight over? What do we get ourselves all churned up about? Nothing. How will I have better yoga? Sitting on that seat being defiant, or leaving the seat, sitting in another little corner, and just remembering Baba? You know, you can see what our emotions get us caught up in, and just little battles and ego, and it's some violence in there. It's something like me against you. That's already violence. And I thought, what is all of this? It's all nonsense. So it was quite good yesterday to have that little experience so I can make it, you know, clear what is emotion and what is feeling. Because when I checked my feelings, I didn't really have anything much on feelings or needs. So drop it. That's what I mean by now I just, if I see it's an emotion, I just drop it because I know it's based on ego. And it was totally based on ego because I didn't really care otherwise. It wasn't an issue I feel I should take up, and I just had lots of good wishes. I thought, it's reserved for 3 days, they told me. So I just had lots of good wishes. I thought, let him do more service for Baba. Let him take all the power and, you know, so what? And that's the thing that you know, and what I'm trying to say is how violence is so subtle. It can come in any kind of attitude, thoughts, feelings. But basically what we learn when we learn how to communicate non-violently is the first thing is to observe. You see, because I could observe and watch myself, it became quite clear what was going on. If I don't stop and observe, I just get into this spin and I don't know where I'm going and I end up somewhere. But observation, and there's a quote something like that. In fact, I brought some notes to share with you because there's some good quotes. And it says, observe. There are few things as important as this. Because if you think about it, what is meditation? The closest word is awareness. And if you want to bring that down, it's to observe. When we're the observer, we've got this comfortable little distance between ourselves and the drama, right? You have that quite naturally? Because most people who meditate, we don't always recognize it, but if you just think, and if you watch yourself over the today, tomorrow, I know for myself, I'm never fully there. I'm always a little bit distant. There's a small little gap between myself and the drama. If I'm right up against the drama, I can't have any space to know what's going on. I will just react. But when I can make this little bit of space, it's comfortable because I'm not up against the drama. So this observation is so important. You okay? So this observation is so important and very, very, very connected to meditation. Meditation's a big word, not for us, but people of the world. But just observe. You know, as Shakespeare says, the world's a stage and we're all actors. You know, an actor's always a bit separate from the part, right? They're observing the role that they're playing. They can't forget that they're just playing a part. Otherwise, they'll mess up the whole thing. They just play their part. So only when we've got this little bit of distance, this observer stage, as Baba says also, when we're an observer, sakshi, then we can be a sati, a companion of Baba. If we're caught up in the drama, we can't stay as Baba's companion because we get pulled into things that are going on. But when we're detached observers, we can stay as a companion pretty much all the time. Is it right? Think about it. When we're a little detached, then we can observe everything with Baba. We feel Baba can be our companion then. But when we get caught up in things, we forget Baba. We just get immersed. So in the four stages of non-violent communication, the first is to observe. Just see what's going on, what am I feeling, what am I needing. You know, this is, first of all, just see. And sometimes it can be, you know, first of all, it can be, you know, what I see. But sometimes when people are accusing or blaming me, I can ask them, when you see this, you know, when you see this, I can also use this to see what's going on for somebody else. You know, some people just react to us and we don't know why. They just, I press buttons, you know, and I don't know why I press buttons. So we can ask them, when you hear me say this, you know, just start to get them to observe. So one is for me to observe, but I can also encourage others to observe. And especially, you know, some parents might be here with children. If we can help the children to practice this from a very young age, just to observe what's going on. And then the second is feeling. So first I observe, and then second, what do I feel? Or if you say to another person, what do you hear, what are you seeing, and how do you feel? You know, it's getting in touch with feelings, because there's something very interesting here. When we are in contact with our feelings and needs, we no longer make good slaves. People can't manipulate us when we're in touch with our feelings and needs, because we take responsibility for them and we try to be clear about them. But if I don't know what I'm feeling and I don't let myself even think about it, I just go along and get myself caught up in many situations. And we grow up labeling, comparing, demanding and judging. We grow up labeling, you're putting labels, you are this, you are that, you are like this. Labeling, comparing, demanding and judging, rather than being aware of feelings and needs. Rather than being aware of my feelings and needs, I think when somebody doesn't fulfill my need, there's something wrong with them. They are like this, they're doing this, they're always like that. Actually, I'm having a feeling and a need, but I blame them because they're not meeting my needs. But they don't even know they're not meeting my needs. You know, what am I putting on other people? Right? Can you see this? Is it too complicated? It's okay? And the separation of observation and evaluation is the highest form of human intelligence. The separation of observing and evaluating. Because what we tend to do is we see and we evaluate. It's such a habit. And that's why we judge and label and do all those things, which are violent. They're a violent way of communicating with others. And what happens also is evaluation gets mixed with exaggeration, right? When we evaluate, we usually start saying things like, you always, you never. So we tend to exaggerate when we do these evaluations as well. So then it's again, you know, putting it on the other person. You always, you know, this is the way we often talk. And when we say, if there's a feel, I feel that, already it's already an opinion and an evaluation. Instead of saying, I feel, you know, when I say, I feel that you always, you know, what is that? Is it a feeling or is it an evaluation of someone else? I feel that you always. Is that a feeling? You see how we communicate normally? Quite a lot of this kind of talk, right? I feel that. I feel you. I feel that you always think like this about me. But no, just be very clear. What do I feel? I feel sad. I feel unhappy, I feel insulted, you know, whatever it is. But what am I feeling? Don't mix this also. And we don't, that's how we don't even know what our feelings are, because we mix it all up. So just coming back to this, so the first is observation. The second is feeling. I feel. Or you can ask someone else, do you feel? You know, if you want to try and bring out what's going on for them. Do you feel sad or do you feel angry? Do you feel whatever? It can be positive also. But we're mostly having a problem with this when it's negative, so I'm keeping it a little bit to the negative. So first is observation. Second is feeling. The third is to express my need. Because otherwise what's usually happening is I try to get my needs met in a not so straight way. And I don't even realize I'm doing it. But I want to get, I have needs. I don't acknowledge that I have needs. But I try to get my needs met. So then everything gets twisted and mixed up. But if I can make this very clear, observe, I feel this. No, when I see this, I feel this. I'm needing this. Like, for example, it could be, when I hear you speaking like that, in that tone to me, I feel disrespected. and I'm needing some respect in our communication. Can you try to speak in a way that connects with me? You know, it's a need. We need. Do you ever feel need to be respected? Do you? Yeah, we do. And yet, sometimes as Brahmins, we feel I shouldn't have any needs. But we do, let's face it. And because we're not facing that we do have needs, we're going about it in a very crooked way. And so that just twists the communication around. So when I can be just clear like this, and then make a request, you know, so when I hear you speaking to me like that, I feel disrespected. I'm needing to have some respect, you know, some mutual respect when we communicate. So can you, you know, really communicate with me when you speak to me? Make a request, because as somebody said also, I don't know how to do a don't. You know, if someone says don't do that and don't do this and don't do this and you always do this, well, what do I do with that? But when I'm just very clear with what I need, and I'm not sure if I read this kind of stuff before I started to do it, maybe I did, but I remember that there came a time in my BK life when I started to communicate clearly. And I thought, well, maybe I'm going to die or something, because usually people are quite honest when they're going to die. Because they got nothing to lose. So I was thinking, how come my communications changed? And I can't remember if I learned this first or it changed first. But I remember just feeling that I could express myself honestly, openly. Might have just come with self-respect. But I just found I was communicating. And I didn't care too much what the other person thought of me. Or, you know, I just felt that I have to be who I am and communicate who I am, you know? I think it came with self-respect, not out of this study. Then the other very big thing is that we often deny responsibility for our actions. We say, well, I did it because the sister in charge told me to do it. I did it because I thought I have to. I did it because everybody else does it. Is that responsible? You know, at the end of the day, when you go through the pearly gates, when you go and meet Baba, there'll be no excuses, right? Oh, I did it because of this, I did it because of that. You did it, you did it. You know, so the thing is to take responsibility. And we need to change our language with the language that acknowledges that I have a choice. And we need to realize that I have a choice in how I behave. Do I not? And one thing that I read some time ago that kind of doesn't leave me and pricks my conscience, it said bad things happen because good people don't do anything about it. Think about it. Bad things happen because good people don't do anything about it. So I have a responsibility to myself and to others to do the right thing, but especially to myself, because at the end of the day, I'm going to face me. There'll be nothing to hide behind. There won't be any benefit from excuses. At the end of the day, I'm responsible for my choices. Isn't it? And to me, this is such a huge step in maturity, to take that responsibility for my choices. But then to think how my language reflects that. And to really use that kind of language that acknowledges that I have a choice. Yeah, so here's this point: judgments, criticisms, diagnosis. You know, we often diagnose other people also. Oh, I think he's depressed, or I think they're this, or whatever, when we diagnose. And interpretations of others are all, it's got here, alienated expressions of our needs. We do that because we're not getting our needs fulfilled. So we label and judge other people. Is it true? When we express our needs indirectly through this use of evaluations, interpretation, and images, then the other person usually hears criticism. They feel they're just being criticized. And then they just become defensive. So that's what often happens in our communication. Because instead of making our needs clear, we evaluate, we judge, we assess other people, and then they become defensive, and nothing is achieved. We're just kind of, neither's really getting anything from that. So the question is, what is it that you are each needing? Because it's not that I just have needs, we both have needs. So in our communication, if we can think of not just what I need, but what do you need? And that's really this compassion, where I'm seeing that you're also human, you also have needs. So for example, this is a good example. I am needing more respect in our dialogue. Okay, so you make it clear. I'm needing more respect in our dialogue. Instead of telling me how you think I am acting, instead of telling me how you think I'm acting, would you tell me what is it that I'm doing that you find disturbing? You know, because they've started to judge and label and blame. So you say to them, instead of telling me how you think I'm acting, can you tell me what I'm doing that you find disturbing? So then it goes back to that observation. Then they'll have to tell you, when you do this, I feel this, I need this, so can you do it like this? So this is what you want to also hear, right, from the other person. So again, what do I want this person to do? What do I want their reason also for doing it? So if I want something from you in terms of our communication, but why do I want you to want to do it? Not just I want you to do this, but that's very deep to think, why do I want you to do that? You know what, because you have to also get something out of whatever's happening. So what it's saying is, diffuse, so reduce stress by listening to your feelings and needs, by empathizing with others rather than labeling them, by asking yourself, what is this person feeling? And what are they needing? And then I'll just share a little bit more, then you can talk amongst yourselves, like in twos or threes, to see what you've understood, and then we can open it up to some questions and dialogue. So this is a very nice point on gratitude. the more you become a connoisseur. You know what's a connoisseur? Someone who enjoys good wine, good food. It means the more you can taste and feel, the more you can taste and feel gratitude, the less you'll be a victim of resentment, depression, and despair. The more you can taste gratitude, the less you'll be a victim of resentment, depression, and despair. Gratitude will act as a nectar that will gradually dissolve the hard shell of your ego. So think about that. When we are more and more grateful, the hard shell of our ego dissolves. Is it your experience? The more we're grateful, the hard shell of our ego softens and dissolves. And gratitude produces true spiritual alchemy. Alchemy means when you can make, like Baba was saying, patra to paras, stone into philosopher's stone, but into a touchstone, into gold. So to make stone into gold, gratitude will be the way to do that between people. When we have gratitude between each other, we create gold. And also another interesting point, alchemist, another interesting point is compliments. Now think about this. Compliments are often judgments, no matter how positive. We think compliments are good, but we have to be quite, again, subtle and check, because compliments are often not completely pure. They've often got a touch of judgment in them. And then receive appreciation without feeling superior or having false humility. This is a very rare thing, that people can accept appreciation without starting to feel arrogant or without feeling a false sense of humility. Actually, I feel David from the art department, I've always felt he's such a good example in this. If you appreciate his painting, he's happy. If you don't, he's also happy. He loves his painting. You know, so he doesn't get phased. If you say, oh, I think this should be a bit different, oh, maybe, you know, but very... And if you say, oh, it's very good, it's good. You know, like there's no false humility, there's no ego. So that's also something to check in gratitude. Good. So just a few ideas on this and notes on this. And if you can just speak with the person near you that speaks your language for 5 minutes. Just see what you feel was a truth for you. Question was, what are you talking about? So I've shared a lot of ideas, but what does it mean to you? How does it apply to you? Were there some insights there? So you can talk about compassion, empathy, needs, feelings. I know you got stopped a little bit abruptly, but we can open it up to questions, comments, insights. Yeah, Richard. That's why I think what somebody said, observation, is the greatest thing, because only if we stay an observer of ourselves will we have this checking and checking and checking. So I think, you know, that's the method that we are using in Brahma Kumaris, of really like keeping a chart. So maybe not just remembering Baba, but also checking whether I'm keeping to this act of non-violence, this act of compassion that we've been talking about. But that's why I say I wish there was a little something on my shoulder that would just catch me. Because it's habit. You know, we've been brought up with a habitual way of communicating, our attitudes, things like that. So we do need reminders. So if you've got a friend that is close to you, that you live with, it's very good to have them also, you know, in a nice way, help you to see when you're getting a little bit off the track here. Yeah. Yeah. Request. The fourth one is request. And again, that's quite, we have to be careful that it's not a demand. Because you can only make a request. If another person changes or they don't change, it's not in your hands, but you can make a request. And I know when people have communicated like this with me, I'm so grateful that they've communicated what they feel. And if they make a request, I take it pretty seriously, because I'm so appreciative to have someone communicate like that to me rather than talk behind my back or, you know, accuse or blame. So when somebody makes the effort to say, you know, when I saw you doing this, or when you spoke to me like this, I felt like that, I'm needing this, can you do this? Then I think, wow, yeah, this, let me really go into this. So I think when we make a request, it's received with a lot of respect, I feel. I feel a lot of respect if someone can communicate with me like that. And I want to encourage it. So I guess that's why I also make an effort to respond in the most conscious way I can, because I'd like to always encourage that kind of communication. Any other comments, questions? Yeah, they come in so many forms. They're often well-intended, because sometimes we'll say to somebody, and I made this mistake myself years ago, someone was sharing their kind of story with me, and I said something like, oh yeah, when I went through that, or when so-and-so went through that, and what I did without realizing is diminish. I wasn't fully present. I already jumped to some solution. So empathy, I guess the one word that describes empathy is being present, fully present with that person. That's empathy. So whenever we're not present, it means we're jumping off to some solutions, or looking for some answers, or diagnosing, or judging, comparing. You know, so when we're not present, we will do one of those things. Again, it's like the mind, you know. So that's why yogis should be very good at this, because that's really what we're trying to practice, being present. And not, you know, letting our head spin like this into other thoughts. You have a question in another language? She says, who's going to translate? She's in the booth. He says, I can't say that. So he's getting his dictionary out. Here's the sister. It's okay, I'll repeat it. Yeah. Yeah. What's the meaning of false humility? In fact, what there was a quote here that I didn't read. Yeah. Thanks. There was a quote here, and actually it was very nice. It says, don't be so humble. You're not that great. You know when somebody compliments you and you go like... He said, don't be that humble. You're not that great. But what it means, this false humility, is not to just accept. You know, like, I give you a very nice example of true humility, I think. I was working with someone and I said to this lady, I said, you're a really nice person, because she was such a nice person. I said, you're a really nice person. She said, I've got many people to thank for that. What a beautiful answer. I've got many people to thank for that. So she accepted it, but it's like, yeah, she's grateful. That's what I think, this grateful really helps our ego to go down. Because whatever we have, we can be grateful for it because we got it from someone or somewhere. Like our knowledge we got from Baba, our virtues we got from Baba, sometimes from our family as well. So being grateful helps us to have true humility that we can accept. Yeah, I'm good at that. But, you know, it's a gift from God. It's, yeah. Because false humility says, no, I'm not, no, I'm not. It's quite hard for most of us to just accept a compliment. And so what we say is that you should swallow, just breathe it in. And just take it in, breathe in, not swallow, breathe in. We do this tunnel of love, you know, when people go through and people say their virtues. And we tell them just to breathe it in, just accept it. So when somebody compliments you and you think, yeah, maybe, just breathe it in. Because we have a habit of rejecting. So let me, if there's not too many more questions, let me connect this because people were asking about the project that I've been working on. And it's very interesting to see the connection between non-violent communication and getting your needs and met and having feelings and all of that in connection with power. Because if you look at it, the way people are using power nowadays, you've got like a spectrum. And at one end, there are people having power over others. Right? Power over. At the other end, there are people who are giving all their power to. Right? Is it right? So what we need to do is to come into the middle so we have power with someone. But at the moment, it's mostly people having power over, but it's also because people are giving them their power. I mean, look at women. Women have only started to have some power in the last 60, 70 years. Otherwise, they let themselves be so submissive and gave their power for thousands of years. Why suddenly are women able now to claim their power just because they decided to? But actually we gave our power. And many ways we give our power. So we don't need to give our power. We need to have power with. Not power over, not giving our power to, but power with. So that was just this connection with the way we're violent towards each other around power. But just to tell you in essence, and I brought some brochures, so if you, I think there's enough, if not I'll get some more. But what this project is about that I'm working on, the future of power, it was initiated by Brother Nizar Juma from Africa. He was the instrument to initiate the Serve Africa. Do you know about Serve Africa? So he was the instrument to open centers in all the countries of Africa, or at least in, you know, initiated, and some maybe have closed now because of difficulties or whatever. But I'll tell you one very sweet thing in that. He went to Baba, he made a big cake, I think a 350 kilo cake of Africa, the whole of Africa. And he presented this to Baba. And he said to Baba, we covered every single country in Africa except for one small island. Do you know what Baba said? Our beautiful Baba, what he said? Consider that to be your beauty spot. You know beauty spot? So beautiful. Because a beauty spot is a black spot, but it's there for beauty. Oh, it's so sweet. So he initiated this project because Baba said in 1975, when there was hardly a dozen double foreigners, hardly, maybe not even a dozen, he said that the main task of the double foreigners is, do you know? To awaken the Kumbhakarna of India, the sleeping giants of India. And no one's really taken that up. So the idea of this project is to awaken the Kumbhakarnas. And that might sound a bit rude, but it's not really, because actually what's happening at the moment is India is progressing. It's becoming, you know, what the world is talking about. There's so many books written about it now, that there's going to be a power shift from the West back to the East, right? And they're all looking at only China and India, only two countries. But as India's been developing, I've met at least 2,000 leaders in India, and they all say the same thing. The more that India's developed, the more the values have gone down, and spirituality. And also what's happening is that they're following the Western model. Some of the things in the West are good, but not all. So I feel what this whole message is about is to say to the Indian leaders, stop. Wrong way, go back. Because what the world needs is spirituality, values, culture. If you see, you know, it's really getting lost very fast. And India's losing its spirituality, values and culture really fast. So fast. So that's what the whole project is about. So when I go to meet people, it really works, because I'm a foreigner and I say to these Indian leaders, I start the conversation by saying that everyone's talking about for some time now a shift of power, and that power is coming back to the East from the West. Because I'm from the West, they really start to listen from that first sentence. If I was Indian and I said that, it would have no impact. But being a foreigner, it has a very powerful impact when we start talking like this. But then what we're doing is we're getting the leaders to talk about. Then the next question is, so what kind of power will India bring to the world? Is India going to be another superpower with guns and money? And all the Indian leaders, they cannot relate to that. I've met the head of nuclear power plants, the district governors of police, the IG police, ministers. They cannot relate to the idea of being a superpower. They can't relate to the word even. They're not like, yeah, we'll be the big superpower. And they always say something like, no, 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 we have to share power. It's very nice. Really very nice. And I asked them, do you think that the world can be led, that we can run the world on soft power, on spirituality, values and culture? 100% yes. 100%. I don't know about you, but I think if I ask people in Australia, they would first of all find it difficult to even understand, but they'd say, oh, it's a nice ideal. But how can you run a world on spirituality, values and culture? But in India, they say, and at least 70% say, it's the only way. Look at the mess now, because we've moved away from spirituality, values and culture. Now look at the world. So they have so much faith in it. And we know as BKs that India will be the next world power, right? So it ties in very well with Gyan, and it's a very good conversation. So we use this word soft power. And I was saying the other day, soft power is very connected with this topic of non-violent communication, because it's all about doing everything with softness, with values, with culture, with spirituality. And, you know, for me, I just really want to only use soft power all the time, because it also means the power of the mind. The power of the mind is soft power. It's not muscle power. So as much as we can do with the mind, that is soft power. So it's got a lot of relevance to where we're at in the drama. And I also think that, you know, Baba says that this is a geopolitical organization. And we've never really explored much about the politics. But actually this is quite political in a way, isn't it? If you think about it, it's quite a political concept. But it's not political because the politics are of spirituality, values and culture. And if you see the biggest problem probably, definitely it has been in India, but in most of the world, is politics. So, you know, when we just bring that to spirituality, values and culture, it has so much relevance. So that's what the project is about. We're doing this, these dialogues in 35 cities around India. We've done 27 already, and we have 7 more to do until March. So I'm here for just a few weeks and then off again. So I've been traveling around, living in at least 35 centers around India, which has been quite an experience. That's another whole topic, because it's really very interesting. Very interesting. So many little things. Like one thing I can just tell you, I teach the sisters in the center how to knock at the door. In India, there's no such thing as privacy. They just walk in. And in a way, I feel sorry because it's quite nice, no? They're all so open like this. But I always lock my door. And I've got a reputation in India. They say, yeah, we heard about you that you lock your door. Because to me, I don't like people just walking in any time, you know, like that. So it's very funny. But they don't know how to knock. They will try the door handle. They've never knocked. They don't know what it is to knock. Isn't that interesting? But it's good in so many ways. It's good because they're so community-like, you know. And sometimes I think, should I teach them to knock at the door? I said, I won't answer the door unless you go like this. Because I don't know what's happening, you know. And I don't know if it's just somebody, you know, scratching. It just sounds like a scratch often when people are trying the handle. So I teach them to knock at the door. Funny, funny little things, but really good. Really, you learn a lot of good things in India. That's what I've appreciated so much. Okay, so let me just repeat this announcement again from transport. Those who are leaving to Ahmedabad from tomorrow, 3rd of January, please check your transportation from the transport office. Baba's bus is not leaving tomorrow. It's cancelled. So reconfirm your transportation again from the transport office today as soon as possible. No, to Ahmedabad. So this is for departures. And also there's another announcement. The latest Mooli is now available in Global Office. So you can pick up copies of this very sweet Mooli of Avyakta Mooli of 31st. Okay, so we'll finish. Om Shanti.